Potter asked about people not wanting to have, like professors not wanting to teach in the afternoon. First, being as a teacher at seminary, I have enough seniority now, even though I look like I'm 20 years old, that I actually always get the morning slots now, because I'm a morning person, you know. I'm not really an afternoon person. That's usually the time to take a nap, unfortunately. So, but I remember Metropolitan Tikhon saying one time, well, I shouldn't have said his name. I remember one seminary professor who said that he was teaching in class, and he kept hearing this voice, and this voice just kept droning on and on and on and on and on and on. He was wondering what this voice was, and eventually he realized that it was him. He'd fallen asleep while I was giving his lecture, and he just kept going, you know? And so he's actually literally asleep giving his lecture. Still talking, but he was wondering who was doing the talking, and it was him. So I guess that's, you know. And I'll try to keep you engaged so that you don't fall asleep, but I know that it's very difficult. I'm going to put that to send it back there. So please sign up on the mailing list if you'd like to. It's a good way to keep in contact with us. The best miracle that I have, even though there's, you know, you kind of forget, so there's so many that happen a lot of times. And of course, miracles are just the confirmation for those who believe. Sometimes people in the gospel, they see the Lord's miracles and they still don't believe. You know, they see Lazarus come out of the tomb and they're like, you know, like, big deal. You know, like, oh, I'm sure he wasn't dead. Or somewhere they can kind of figure out a way to explain it away. And we can do that very quickly in our own life, because the reality is that the greatest miracle is the fact that we're here today, that we're Christians, that we're alive, and we're serving our Lord, and that we know the Lord. How great it is, a great blessing and a great miracle to be able to be called a Christian. It really is. Great miracle. It's a fabulous gift. And just the fact that we're alive. I mean, nobody asked us if we wanted to be alive. Here we are. You know, we can pick out what kind of clothes we want to wear, pick out our hairstyle, our glasses. We didn't pick out if we wanted to live or not. It's a gift. It's a miracle. The fact that we're all here, we're called Christians. But the most phenomenal miracle, just as of late, that I said last night, which I was just floored over because it happened a second time. I mentioned that there was a drought in Colorado, and we went to Colorado with St. Anna. The priest there was a Romanian background, and he said, you know, they used to have this pilgrimage in Romania, so we had the special services, and we'd like to do that here because we're having a drought now, and we want to do the special prayers and the special service, and we had several priests there, and so we all went around in procession around the church. Everybody passed underneath the icon like they passed underneath the Pashanitsa at Pascha, or on Holy Friday. And then within a few days, it started raining, and they had plenty of snow, you know, the next year. So it went very well in Colorado. And so when we went to California the last time in November, was there November 7th or something like that? And the priest there, I told him, I said, you know, in Colorado, St. Anna helped to bring a lot of water. And I said, I think we should do the same thing here. So I got out the prayer. We got also there's a very long service for the ending of a drought. And I actually called up Metropolitan Tikhon that day and said, can I have your blessing for it to rain here? Yes. And I called up Archbishop Benjamin, can I have your blessing for it to rain here? Yes. So I had all my bases covered. And then we went ahead and we proceeded with the service. We had three priests. And we ran around the church and we said the prayers at all the four corners of the church. And we had the kneeling service where we say several long prayers. Each priest took quite an extensive prayer. And then within 2 days of being there, it rained. And it rained, and it rained, and it rained. And it rained for 2 months without stopping. 2 months in a place where it hadn't rained consistently for 5, 6, 7 years. Like almost no rain. And for it to rain for 2 months. And in fact, they had to close the schools. In my hometown of Fremont, California, they closed the schools because they had never seen rain like that before, ever. And then kind of the aside was, is that when I went home and I heard that it started raining, my back went out immediately. And when it stopped raining, my back came back and I was fine. But I just always think of I'm not going to say anything in the sense of it's definitely connected, but the reality is no good deed goes unpunished. Mm-hmm. Somebody's got to pay the bill. And maybe it was me. So, but that was the great miracle as of late. There's been so many people, like I mentioned last night, about the woman who she came with her daughter. Her daughter couldn't have children. And this is just, you know, story after story of people who can't have children, because St. Anna, St. Joachim and Anna, you know, they were barren. They couldn't have any children. And they were living at the time of 20 BC or 30 BC, whatever it was. And it was one of the greatest curses in the world, in the Jewish world, to be without children. It was a sign that God had abandoned you. Why? Because their sense of eternity wasn't in the sense of like we understand it now. They had a different sense of the world and a different sense of life, and they saw that their eternal existence went through their children. And so when you didn't have kids, that means, in effect, you were kind of like doomed to hell in a way, because your lineage, your line, could not continue. And so even though they had the hope of the resurrection in some kind of very distant kind of shadow, hope of something, you know, like Joseph asking that his bones be removed from Egypt when they went out of Egypt in Exodus. The patriarch Joseph said, please take my bones. Why would he say that if he didn't hope that there was a resurrection? Don't leave me here with these people, basically. But for them, not to have children, it was seen as a curse. It was seen that there was something wrong with them, something they lacked, something, and ultimately it was seen as a spiritual problem. So they prayed, and 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 they prayed. And they were both very old. And the mother of God was finally born. And if you read the life of St. Joachim, it's a beautiful story about how Joachim was refused at the temple, and he went and he wept in the wilderness and just cried his eyes out to God. And the same thing, Anna, being just so sad that they couldn't help. Kind of, you know, I think even that last prayer they said that Anna made was before she conceived, was that she could just be somehow affiliated with the one who would bring forth the Messiah. You know, that maybe that this child could serve the one who would be like the mistress of creation, the one that would be like the virgin spoken of in Isaiah. That this little girl could just be the one that would just maybe be able to help her a little bit. And so after these fervent prayers and this great longing, they were able to conceive, and they bore Mary, the Mother of God. They were the most righteous and chaste and just people that lived in the time of Israel. They were holy people. They were the best people. They gave, you know, they were very wealthy people, believe it or not. And they gave abundantly to the temple, abundantly to the poor, abundantly to everybody in every way. So she's especially known for people helping people who can't have children. And so this woman came, she brought her daughter, and her daughter was not able to have a child for some medical kind of reason. It was 30s, mid-30s or something, the daughter. And the woman literally came in on her knees. She was crying all the way up to the icon in the chapel. You know, she came in immediately on her knees and on her knees all the way up to the icon. And then we did a short prayer service for her and for her daughter, and that family was there, and they were very thankful, very tearful. And I got a phone call about, I don't know, 8 months ago, 9 months ago. My understanding of time is different than yours, because I live in a monastery where it's just like, it's a different time zone. It's just different. I can't explain. I went to the monastery when I was 23. I still look like I'm 23. That gives you the idea of, like, I'm 40 years old, you know. So it gives you an idea of, it's just a different, I can't explain what it is, but it's a different time zone. And so whenever she called, it was a while ago, this lady on the phone, she says, the baby, there's a baby. I was like, hello, there's a baby, my baby, it's the baby was born. I was like, this is a monastery, this is not the hospital. I was like, hello? And she's like, the baby was born. She says, my name is such and such and such, and you prayed for us, and my daughter couldn't have children, and the baby was born last night. I was like, thank God, that's so wonderful to know that. You know, it's real. It's real. We have the reality of the monastery is that there's just so many miracles that happen, not because of us, but because God is merciful. And a lot of times we have not because we ask not. You know, that's what the scriptures say. There's one couple that we have another miracle working icon in the monastery, the Mother of God. And we went, and again, it's the same thing that's known for people who can't have children. They couldn't have a baby. We went, we said the prayer, we anointed them with oil. They went away, and then I baptized their child a year later. You know, and so that's the reality of the monastery. The altar itself is extremely powerful. The altar of God. And the older the altar, the more that people serve the liturgy and pray at that altar, the stronger it becomes. And so, you know, like the saying from your mouth to God's ear, it's like, for me, that's the monastery. You know, like, really, like, if you look at all of the prayers of consecration in the Orthodox Church, all of those prayers basically say, it's in the Second Chronicles chapter 7 and chapter 6. If you look at the consecration in the Old Temple, in the Old Testament, you'll see a lot of the prayers that we use. Basically, they said, if somebody who comes to this place and asks for something, may you hear their prayer, may you answer their prayer, may your eyes always be open in this place, may your ears always hear the prayers offered in this place, may this place become an effectual place so that your throne is right here and that we can contact you, that we can touch you, that we can know you, and that you can hear us and you can answer us. So there's, you know, in the Old Testament, it's beautiful the way it's said. It's almost poetic. It's like, you know, and if you have this problem, and if this is going on, then come to the temple and do this, and God will hear, and God, you know, like, I think it's, the best one is, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray. If they turn from their sins, I will hear, and I will forgive, and I will heal their land. And it's in that same context of the Chronicles chapter, you know, about the temple. It's always directed towards the temple, towards the altar. And so I always know that, like, I remember one Metropolitan Herman, when he would come, we had a drought in South Canaan one time. And so what do? You go into the closet, you get out the book, you open up the book and it says, ask for rain, you read the prayer during liturgy, and it starts raining. And that's what happened. We got out of church, it was raining. It was like, to me, it was like, yeah, that's what's supposed to happen. But the reality is that's the church. The reality is that's the holy monasteries. When you go and you ask, God does give. God does answer our prayers. Miracles happen all the time. We see them so often at the monastery that they're commonplace, and it's not because of our own holiness, it's because of the mercy and grace and love of God. And it's not like something that we're doing. All we are is just poor, sinful people who are trying to follow the Lord, and it's very, very hard, just like it is for you. What do we have to offer to the Lord? You know, when it really gets down to it, our righteousness, all the good things we do, does God really want all that stuff? You know, we always hear about the when we prepare for Lent, right? We have the Sunday of the publican and the Pharisee, right? And the one guy goes to church and he says, God, you should be thankful that I'm here. I do so much for you. And all these people, what do they do for you? They don't do anything for you. Look at that guy over there. Right? That's the publican and the Pharisee. Remember that story? Everybody knows what I'm talking about, right? And what does the publican do? He's in the very back of the church, and he's just on his knees, and he's saying, God, be merciful to me, the sinner. I know I've done absolutely nothing good. Have mercy on me. And that man went out, and he was justified. God heard his prayer. The other guy was like, you know, like, it was almost like he'd be doing like this. Like nothing coming out of his mouth. He couldn't. I remember one story that reminds me of St. George. He came to the abbot of this one monastery. The abbot told this kind of ties into what we were talking about earlier, about having a good heart and doing what we do with the right disposition. But the abbot, he told the monastic choir, he said, you guys don't sing this big feast day this year, because I'm going to have a special choir come in from the cathedral to take your place. And they were all kind of upset and dejected. Because, you know, the monastic choir sometimes, like, you know, sometimes a little scary, but they have a good heart, you know? So they step off to the side, and this big choir, they come in, and they really wow everybody, and everybody's so happy. It's such a good day, big day, you know? So the abbot finally, he's done with the festival, the feast day. He goes back to his room, he lies down, and hears this knocking on his door. Who is it? I just laid down. I'm so tired. We've had such a long day. Yes, yes, yes. Okay, come on. Hold on, hold on. He opens up the door to St. George. St. George is the patron of the monastery. And he said, you forgot my feast day. I said, what are you talking about, St. George? He said, we just had a great feast day. He said, all these people, this great choir. I said, what are you talking about? He says, I saw the people and I heard absolutely nothing. Why? Because they didn't have the right heart. It was all for show. It was all this big kind of, you know, it was all to impress and to show up to everybody about how great the monastery was, but St. George wasn't happy with it. Why? Because it wasn't done with that right disposition. So anyways, what do we have to offer God but you know, our poverty, our weakness, and our lack? You know, the first beatitude is blessed are the poor in spirit. Why? We sing it every Sunday. Almost, maybe, depending on your tradition. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Why? Because theirs is the kingdom of heaven. That's the first beatitude. And the beatitudes are like a stepladder of how to get to heaven. They show kind of the ascent or the progression of spiritual life. And the very first spiritual life is basically admitting that, you know what, I don't really have much to offer, and I really can't do this myself. That's the first step of spiritual life. It's like AA, right? I'm powerless, and I'm really no good when it gets down to it. I can't seem to do the right thing. That admonition of weakness, that admonition of our powerlessness is ultimately the first step towards power, towards acquiring God's power, and ultimately towards something better. Because it's in that moment when we're weak, that's when God can become strong and we can know God's strength. So anyways, the monastery is just, there's so many miracles that happen a lot of the time. And it's not by any virtue of the holiness of the monastics, but rather the holiness of the monastery. And the reality of our faith. The reality of our faith. You know, there's a great quote from one of these poets, and he said, to those who wish to see, God gives sufficient light. To those who don't want to see, God gives sufficient darkness. Do you understand?
I don't get it.
If we want to see, there's sufficient light for us to see. God gives it. But if we don't want to see, God says, okay, that's fine. I'll give you sufficient darkness. I'm still the one who's giving. I'm still the one who's in charge. I'm still ultimately the author of this universe and of this life. And it's up to us what we do with it. So there's so many miracles, and these hands themselves are two children that were born, and they were a Greek family, and they had the initials inscribed with the children on each of the hands. So it's a great blessing. And in fact, she actually wept at Christmas time when she was in Michigan again. She went on a tour of this area, and she wept at one of these parishes for a little while, so it was kind of unusual.
Did something happen here or something?
What's that?
Did something happen in Michigan or something?
I don't know. But she wept for a little while. It was like for a day or something like that. So she still is active in the sense of, you know, an active presence and an active, again, a true miracle-working icon. So before I go on, does anybody have any questions?
The relics that you have, the side there, could you explain what those are?
Well, this is St. Anna, St. Joachim, and a little piece of the belt of the Mother of God.
Are they parts of their bones?
They're parts of their bones, yeah. In fact, they have St. Anna's foot on Mount Athos, and it's still warm. I don't know if any of you have seen that. There's an interesting book that they have. It's the East and West Saints. They're called the Incorruptibles. The Incorruptibles are basically, I don't know if any of you know St. John Maximovich in San Francisco, he's incorruptible. His body is still totally intact. You can see his fingers, his beard. He's dark, you know what I mean? He's not soft or anything, but he's still there completely. And what is that a sign of, do you think? Kind of puzzling. It is a sign, it is a miracle for the world.
Is it because he's kind of like with God or something?
Yeah, very much so. it shows that the grace of God abode in him so much that it actually preserved him. Because what is God if not life? And what is to be apart from God if not death? And it's really an issue of ontology in the sense of it really gets down to just it's as simple as when you're with God, you have life. Without God, there is no life. There's only death. And so when the saints are with God, sometimes as a sign of that superabundant grace that so fills not only their heart, but even their very fingertips, their fingernails, their hair, their beard, their lips, their teeth, every part of them gets so suffused with this life-giving grace that it actually preserves them and reveals to us that man wasn't created to die. That with the grace of God, man lives forever, not only his soul, but even his body. And to me, St. John Maximovich is just waiting there for the second coming. He's just waiting there. And in fact, there's plenty of saints in Russia. There's one of them that's still warm, St. Joe of Machaya. You open up the little window in his booth, and you touch his hand, and it's soft and warm. And he's 500 years old. St. Anna's foot, it's still warm. Mary Magdalene, her arm or something, her hand, I can't remember what they have, it's still warm. St. John Chrysostom, he has his incorruptible hand is on Vatelhedy, and they bless people with it all the time. And it's like this hand, you know? It's encased in silver and so forth. I don't know if anybody's seen pictures of it, but you can Google it. You know, Google St. John Chrysostom's hand, incorrupt hand. And you see these pictures of this hand, and the priest will actually bless you, giving you St. John Chrysostom's blessing. Can you imagine that?
Is his ear also preserved where the angel
formed him? Yeah, in his head, his ear is incorrupt because of St. Paul spoke into his ear for all of his gospel commentaries.
With his hand, how do they do it? Like, they grab his hand and do something
that? It's just his hand. So it's like if you imagine, you know, just this part of me. They put it in silver and they take it and they bless people with it.
Like
it's
actually the sign of a cross with it?
Yeah, it's in the sign of a blessing, priest blessing already. So.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I heard something about the myrrh, the tears that was analyzed. Could you talk about that a little bit, please?
Well, there's two icons that are weeping myrrh that I know right now in America. One of them is in Taylor, Pennsylvania, and one of them is in Hawaii. And so many miracles, just an incredible amount of miracles are attributed to these icons. They're the Mother of God. And the myrrh itself, it smells like paradise. It's every icon that's a miracle-working icon has its own unique fragrance. It's kind of very flowery, very floral, kind of sweet-smelling, but each of them are completely unique to each icon. So even though the Taylor icon was originally, it started weeping because of contact with the Hawaiian Aviran icon of the Mother of God, both of them smell different. And sometimes the myrrh is orange in one, and sometimes the myrrh is yellow on the other one, and sometimes it's clear. Sometimes it's like water. You know, the other day, like I mentioned last night, I was there, and the priest takes it out of the case, and it's like rain coming out of the icon. It just starts, like, puddling, you know, like just pouring out of this icon. And I remember one lady, this is an interesting miracle from that icon. We could sit around and talk about these all day, but this lady, she was a radiation oncologist, a nurse in that ward, and she had a brain tumor. And she was anointed with this myrrh, and she took a little bit of it home in the cotton swab, and she put it under her pillow, and she prayed to the Mother of God every night. And she was actually in stage 4. Brain cancer, you know, and she worked there at the place at the hospital, you know, one of the best places I think of Sloan Kettering, and within a week, this goo started coming out of her nose, and it was like the tumor was actually melting and coming out of her nose, and she blew this tumor out of her nose, and they analyzed it was the cancer. And she was fine. She went on to live a very happy, successful life. It was just like a year ago, less than a year ago. She's fine now. But this tumor literally dissolved into her brain and came out her nose.
Wow.
You know, and it was somebody that we knew. You know, it wasn't just like, and she wasn't really like a devout, pious Orthodox or something. She was Catholic, and she was just like some lady that, you know, just was in trouble. She didn't really, you know, she went to church as much as she could, as much as her job allowed, but she wasn't like a nun or anything. And she just, you know, because, you know, the reality is that God is, he looks at everybody exactly the same. There's no respecter of persons with God, and that kind of is a little bit scary. Because we tend to think like, well, God, don't you know it's me? It's like, of course you wouldn't throw me into hell, right? I mean, it's me, you know. You know me, right? It's like we don't realize that the reality is that God loves us so much that he would allow us to go our own way and even to reject him. You know, like they say, the gates of hell are locked from the inside. Ultimately, it's our choice. There are some people in this world who say to God, thy will be done. And there are some people in this world, ultimately, who God will say to them, thy will be done.
What does that mean?
Because ultimately, we have enough freedom. God has given us, in creating us in his image, you know, we're not in his likeness, we're in his image. We're created in the image of God. First and foremost, that means that we're self-determining, autonomous persons or individuals who can choose our own way. That's one of the greatest gifts that we have, is that we're totally free. And God honors that more than we could even ever understand. And that's why when we talk about hell, the reality is that we're talking about the creation of man, not the creation of God. Right? It's man's own choice to choose to go away from God. And so the scary thing is that any of us, and even as a monastic, I've experienced hell on the most deepest kind of real existential level, because I have to have that experience myself to understand what it's like to almost not be able to get out. To almost not be able to get out of that self-isolating rejection of God. We have to experience all of that breadth and height in order to really understand Christian life. And if we are to follow Christ, to some degree, everything that happened to him, even the descent into hell, will happen to us as well, if we really follow the Lord. And it's very important for us to remember this, is that the principal movement, you know, the fall was so cataclysmic. Remember I talked about this morning about how as a society and as a people and just as humankind, we all have very, very bad amnesia. Come on in. The water's fine. Come on up to the front end. Welcome. We all have very, very bad amnesia. The sense of we don't know where we came from. We really don't know where we're going. The reality is that the fall was so cataclysmic that this cross is a symbol of life. And the reality is that if you want to go to heaven, the first movement is down. It's not up. Christ shows us. He came from heaven, he descended, and then he descended again. And ultimately, if we're going to follow him to heaven, we're going to have to descend. We're not going to ascend. Who is the one that wanted to ascend and set his heights, his throne next to God's, and be like God? Who is the one that was involved in the ascent? Lucifer, right? In Isaiah, right? So if we want to ascend, the true ascent is the descent. And Christ shows us that. Why? Because after we ourselves are hanging on our own cross, and after we say, into thy hands I commit my spirit, I'm not going directly to heaven. I begin my journey down. Like St. Paul, we have to say, I die daily. I'm crucified to the world, St. Paul says. And so in the same way as Orthodox Christians, as Christians in general, we too have to be crucified to the passions, to the sins, to the lust, to all those things that corrupt us and make us ultimately divide our attention and love between God and the world. So important, though, because a lot of times people will come to the monastery, let's say even monastics or seminarians or whatever, they come there, and this is applicable to everybody, if we really want to have some kind of spiritual life, it actually will start getting more difficult sometimes. And we'll wonder why. And then, well, I thought, God, I'm going with you now. Shouldn't things become easier? Shouldn't this get a lot easier now? Because, you know, I'm with basically the master of the universe, the one who created everything. But the reality is no. This world crucified Christ. It wasn't easy for him. And it won't be easy for us. And I'm not saying that to scare anybody. It's just to help keep everything in perspective, because ultimately the best life is the one that's lived for the Lord. And the best place to be is to be with the Lord. And the best person to share our love with is to share our love with the Lord, because the reality is this.